Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another special episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we are still celebrating our one-year anniversary. We started the Bodybuilding Legends podcast on July 5th, 2017. So we have done one full year of podcasts. So in order to celebrate, we had a special show last week and also for this week, in which we are going to be playing some of my favorite clips from some of my favorite interviews from the last year. So on last week's show, we covered seasons 1, 2, and 3, which was the anniversary of Pumping Iron on season 1. And then season 2 was our Mr. Olympia series, where we talked to Dorian Yates, Lee Haney, and Chris Dickerson. And then season 3 was the 1981 Mr. Olympia. So today we are going to be reviewing clips from some of my favorite shows from season 4, which was the 1990 Mr. Olympia. And then we're going to go over season 5, which was the NABBA Mr. Universe contest. And then finally, we're going to go over season 6, which was the Larry Scott years, where we talked about Larry Scott winning the Mr. Olympia in 1965 and 1966. All right, before we get to that, I want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Redcon One. Everybody wants to be a champion. Everyone wants to be the best. At Redcon One, they believe in working hard to achieve your goals. Whether you're killing it in the gym or running a six-minute mile, Redcon One has something for those willing to put in the work. Their premier clinically dosed pre-workout called Total War is the perfect companion to your workout to give you that extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. After the workout, you can fuel your body with the revolutionary MRE. This is the only whole food complete meal replacement, with protein coming from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs, and carb sources coming from sweet potatoes and oats, and it also contains 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. This is the best tasting complete meal you will ever have. And be also sure to check out their MRE bars, which is a new addition to Redcon One, and they have a lot of different flavors. So go to redcon1.com and try the very best that sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon One, the highest state of readiness. And if you order anything from Redcon One, be sure to enter the discount code LEGENDS, and you will get a 15% discount off your order. All right, we're also brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I have been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors, no sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe title in 2012. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 Classic Physique Olympia champion and also the 2018 Classic Physique Arnold Classic champion. And Breon is gearing up quickly to defend his title at the Mr. Olympia this year in the Classic Physique division. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 when you go on and order supplements from Old School Labs, and you will get 12% off your order at oldschoollabs.com, or you can go to amazon.com and order your Old School Labs supplements from there. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, I hope everybody's having a good summer. It's now the middle of July, and it is hot out here in Tampa, and I guess it's hot many other places across the country. I know it's been hot in Chicago, and I think the West Coast, LA, is really getting some hot weather. So I hope you guys are staying cool and enjoying your summer. We had some good interviews this last week with Phil Williams and Craig Munson. So both of those guys are going to be talking about the Old School Bodybuilding, which is our new season on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So we will have those shows up in the next couple of weeks after we are done celebrating our one-year anniversary. So Phil was good to talk to. I've gotten to know him pretty good, especially since I worked out with him out in California last month when I was out there for Memorial Day. So Phil's always been a great bodybuilder, great inspiration to me. And he's one of those guys that was never really celebrated, but he is definitely an old school bodybuilder who really loves the sport. So we got to talk about a lot of things, not only his training at Gold's Gym, but before that, Phil grew up in Missouri. So he trained at George Turner's gym out in St. Louis. And George Turner, for those of you who don't know, was a real legendary trainer. He trained a lot of bodybuilders and he really knew a lot. And he had a great gym out in St. Louis. In fact, Phil said it's probably the best gym that he's ever worked out in his life. So he's got some great stories from that. And he's also got some good stories from when he was out in Sweden, because he met his first wife. I think she was living when he was out in L.A. And she was visiting from Sweden. He ended up marrying her and moving to Sweden. And he really had some great success in his bodybuilding career living out there, because he said it was the perfect lifestyle to be a bodybuilder out in Sweden. And I think when he was living out there, that's when he won the NPC Nationals in 1985 and also the NPC USA in 1984. Phil had some really, really good stories. So we're going to have that interview up in the next couple of weeks. And we also got a chance to talk to Craig Munson. And Craig is another bodybuilder, sort of like Phil, that wasn't really well known. He didn't ever get his pro card. He never competed in the Mr. Olympia, but he was a huge bodybuilder. Probably 6'2", around 275, with 23-inch arms. And he would train down at Venice Beach, Muscle Beach, out in the boardwalk during his years in bodybuilding. And he also trained at Gold's Gym. And when we did the interview with Larry Jackson a few weeks ago, Larry was talking about Craig and how huge he was. So Craig's got a great story, a very interesting story. He spent some time in prison. So we had some really good interview with both Craig and Phil. So those interviews will be coming up, like I said, in the next couple of weeks. I also want to mention I have a new thing on my bodybuildinglegendshow.com website. It's called Patreon. And this is a Patreon is an organization that allows listeners of podcasts or people who go on websites or whatever to contribute to the show. So if you would like to be a patron of the show of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, when you go on the bodybuildinglegendshow.com website, it is on the upper right-hand corner. You just click on it, and you can be a patron of the website and contribute to the show if you so choose. You can contribute as little as $5 a month or $10 a month, and that just helps us to keep putting on shows out here on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, doing the interviews, paying for the production costs, websites, equipment, and everything, traveling. So if you want to do that, I would really, really appreciate your help. Thank you for considering that, and we have different prizes available or different things that I'm giving to each patron depending on what level you choose. So if you want to go on there, like I said, it's on the bodybuildinglegendshow.com website, which is my website, and it's in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. So check that out, and I really appreciate it. Anybody who helps us out here so we can continue putting on some great shows for the next year. Speaking of great shows, the John Torelli interview is now wrapping up. This will be part two of our video interview for John, and I'm just about done editing it, so that will definitely be up this month in the month of July. And then right after that, we were going to follow up with the Lee Labrada interview. So I did a great interview with Lee Labrada. That'll also be in two parts, because Lee had a really long career, and we're able to put a lot of great video clips in there and a lot of great pictures of when Lee was at his peak. And he only spent 10 years as a professional bodybuilder, but he really made his mark on the sport, especially in the area of posing and just presenting a really, truly classic, symmetrical physique. And like I said in the interview, he marched to his own beat because he did not listen to the critics who said he always had to get bigger, and he stuck to what he thought was the perfect physique for him, and it really paid off for him. Lee took second place in the Mr. Olympia twice, and came very close to winning the Arnold Classic, and he won the Night of the Champions, as well as many, many other Grand Prix shows. But it wasn't just the shows that he won. It was more of the physique that he presented, and like I said, the impact that he made on the sport, which is still felt to this day, because I think he still believed, you know, he still agreed upon as one of the best bodybuilders ever. When we did that interview with Lee Haney, we had that clip of that show last week on our Bodybuilding Legends podcast anniversary special. Lee was talking about how Lee Labrada was such a great poser, and he had such an impact on the stage when he posed. So that is going to be a great interview. I'm really looking forward to sharing that with you guys. And that, like I said, will be coming up in the next couple of weeks, maybe the first weekend in August. Also, I have some exciting news. I am working on the Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends book, Volume 2. I brought out Volume 1 last year. I think it came out like in November, and it was a big hit. A lot of people really liked it. I've done 3 books so far on Amazon.com, and I also did the MP6 workout, and I also did my new one, which is Diary of a Natural Bodybuilder. But I think of the 3, the Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends book, Volume 1, was the most popular. I've sold more books of that than the other 2. There's definitely a lot of people out there who enjoy reading those stories of the great contests from the golden era of bodybuilding. So in Volume 1, of course, I concentrated on the 1970s, and that was all the battles that Sergio and Arnold had at the Mr. Olympia, and also Frank Zane's Mr. Olympia win, and some of the other competitions in the late 70s. And then we finished with the 1980 Mr. Olympia. So Volume 2 will begin with the 1981 Mr. Olympia. So there's 2 chapters that cover that contest because it was such a controversial contest. In fact, we did a whole series of interviews right here on the podcast about the 1981 Mr. Olympia. But we got a lot of other stuff in there talking about the 1980s, including when Lee Haney first won the Mr. Olympia, Samir Banute winning the Mr. Olympia, and also a lot of great amateurs like Tim Belknap and Lance Dreher. And it's going to be a really, really great book. So I'm putting it together now, and I'm hoping to have that available for sale next month. So in a few more weeks, really. That's also one of the things I offer on our Patreon account. So if you become a patron of the show and want to contribute, that is one of the things you can get, the Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends book, Volume 2. All right. And I also want to mention that we are brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they are there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number at 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's FL for Florida, alternativemeds.com, or call them directly at 813-922-8939. And if you mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, you will get a free consultation plus 20% off of your order. All right, so I want to thank Florida Alternative Medicine, Redcon One, and Old School Labs for again sponsoring this special episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, well, let's get started with our clips here. We are going to start off with Season 4, which was the 1990 Mr. Olympia. And that 1990 Mr. Olympia, of course, was the only Mr. Olympia in history where they decided to do drug testing. So it was a very controversial contest. It was a very unique contest. And we were able to talk to many people involved in that contest, including Dr. Bob Goldman, who was a drug testing person who did that. And we were also able to talk to many of the competitors who were in that show. And one of the competitors was Sean Ray. And Sean Ray ended up taking 3rd place at the 1990 Mr. Olympia. But what's unique about Sean Ray is that they also did drug testing at the Arnold Classic earlier that year. And Sean won the Arnold Classic in 1990. And then he found out 2 weeks later that he failed the drug test and he had to give back the trophy and the money. So only about 6 months or 7 months later, Sean competed in September at the Mr. Olympia and he passed the drug test and he placed 3rd place. So in this clip, we are going to talk to Sean about whether he thought drug testing was a good idea for pro bodybuilding. Here we go. What do you think the reason is that they didn't continue with it? Do you think it's because the fans didn't want it or because they just didn't have that drug testing down?
Listen, you can't, it's bodybuilding 101, you know?
Yeah.
They have natural federations and they do their thing, but we're grown men, you know? You have non-smoking section, you have a smoking section, you have the guys that drink alcohol, the guys that don't. We're grown men. It's hard to tell grown men what they can and can't do with their own bodies. And at the end of the day, you know, the power lifters, the football players, the track and field athletes. I mean, you single one out, you got to go after everybody. And back in those times, John, you know, bodybuilders weren't dying from steroids. So it's almost like we're trying to push back by going, look, You know, go after the guy over here who's got cancer and he's still smoking cigarettes. Go after the guy over here who's drinking beyond the limits and he's getting in his car and he's driving. I mean, you guys are the ones that are trying to enforce drug testing on us. Like, for me, I think I would have welcomed drug testing if it could have stuck, but we would have had a different sport. And then you lose its popularity because we're not looking at these people that are like works of art. I mean, drugs has just a negative connotation. If they didn't work, people wouldn't take them. The problem that we had is the regulation of it all. It's black market, it's voodoo science, and you got guys that if a little bit's good, a lot must be better, and one drug leads to another. So I think initially the purpose was to try to like save us from ourselves. Because you have that guy, you have those bodybuilders that don't know their limitations, and of course they die of something related, you know, whether it's Oxycontin or freaking heroin. I mean, there's a lot of bodybuilding related deaths that were precipitated by their steroid use or steroid abuse. And then you have smart guys like Labrada and Rich Gaspari, these scientists, guys that, you know, they're able to find their way through it and use it properly to where it benefits them and not abuse it. But even in that, having a third party trying to regulate it would have cannibalized our sport to the point where we wouldn't have had athletes. And when Vince McMahon brought it into his WBF Bodybuilding Federation, he wound up with a fat Mike Quinn. I mean, Mike Christian wound up looking like garbage because they were doing whatever they wanted, and the drug testing was the reason why they didn't feel like they needed to train hard because they were going to get paid no matter what. So it was a very slippery slope. But look, there's federations that have drug tests. Let those athletes go there. Let these bodybuilders do what they want to do. That's where I come from, because as a grown man, I don't want to have someone tell me how fast to drive my car. I know if I drive my car fast, I'm subject to crash and burn or get a speeding ticket. I know that. But let me drive my car. Now, when it comes to my body, let me do what I want to. Girl, we can't tell a woman whether or not she can get boob implants. You know, we can't tell a woman whether or not she can get a hysterectomy,
right,
or have an abortion or whether she needs to be on birth control. So when you start getting into these sports and you want to tell a guy what he can and can't do, that's where you're going to run into problems. The sport, it will change the appeal of the sport to the degree that the governing bodies may be out of work. You know, the Mr. Olympia may disappear because nobody wants to compete anymore. And now the whole machine falls apart. The supplement industry is suffering, the gym suffering, the trainers are suffering, and now you don't even have bodybuilders anymore. So the slippery slope that I can't figure out, it's like the Rubik's Cube. I'm all for drug testing. I mean, if we didn't have to take drugs, we probably wouldn't have other problems. But this is body dysmorphia. These athletes, they come in because they have low self-esteem. They come in because they're fat, because they're skinny, because they're weak, because they want to be supermen and all these things. And they bring all of their vices with them, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it's on public display. And when you try to regulate it, you're going to have episodes that happened in 1990 at the Arnold Classic, and now the federation looks bad. I survived it. I actually thrived after that. My career took off after I failed a drug test.
Right.
I mean, I'm not wearing it as a badge of honor. I was the first guy to ever fail a drug test. But you know what? I came out on the other side better than it. Ben Johnson was ruined.
Yeah.
You know? Lance Armstrong, he was ruined. And who's there that black chick in the track and field? Yeah. There's so many careers that were ruined. And, you know, Mark McGuire kind of side-skirted things, Sammy Sosa, guys who are, but I mean, they were doing it in every sport. So at the time, and remember, we got to keep the context, at the time in the 90s, it wasn't a taboo. We look at it now, oh, steroids, oh, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't a taboo, and the athletes pretty much had a handle on it. It wasn't until later when we got into growth hormone and insulin and Oxycontin and GHB and all this other, and all these gurus that we started seeing bodybuilders die. And no one's accountable. No one's responsible. And the only thing we can say it's because of is because of the steroids, which still the general public doesn't understand that there's not a steroid. There's as many steroids as there are vitamins on the market. And there's women that use steroids. There are benefits to its use. We run into a problem when it's abused. Hell, if I eat too much steak, I'm going to have a problem, right?
Yeah.
If I drive my car too fast, too soon, I'm going to have a problem. So I don't know who monitors that, but right now, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, being 17 years removed from the stage, if we did it all over again, I don't know what they could change. The smart thing they did was getting rid of the drug test. That was the smartest thing they did, because bodybuilding took off in the 90s bigger than it ever was in the 80s after that drug test.
All right, now in this clip, Sean is going to talk a little bit more about the drug testing, and he's going to talk about how the judging procedures of especially choosing bodybuilders who were bigger than they were in the 1970s and 80s. In other words, choosing bodybuilders for mass instead of just symmetry and aesthetics really changed the sport of bodybuilding. Sean is a very articulate and well-spoken person, and he really knows his stuff, and he also knows the history of the game. So this is going to be a really fascinating clip about what Sean says right here. Do you think if they would have did the drug testing, if they would have figured it out, that the sport would have taken a different direction, we wouldn't have had the mass monsters like Dorian and then Ronnie?
Absolutely. I don't know if it would have been better or worse, because those guys brought a lot. They brought a lot to the sport, irrespective of the negative, you know, bloated stomachs and the quest for size. I think if we wanted to change the sport, we would have had to change the judges. And that wasn't happening in the 90s. Under the tutelage of Wayne D'Amelio. So you got the same, they got force fed the same thing all the time. Mm-hmm. Now, had the judges changed, Labrada could have had Olympia, I could have had Olympia, Kevin Lavrone could have had Olympia, hell, Vince Taylor could have had one. And it would have changed the dynamic of the interest in our sport. So I don't think that the drug testing would have been more effective as opposed to changing the judges on a year to year basis so that everyone had a fair shot at winning. Because, you know, you got 53 years of the Mr. Olympia and you got 13 champions. So I still say do the math, you know, same judges, same results. And I went out on the Mr. Olympia stage in 2001, fighting that, that sentiment at the press conference in 01 that look, until you guys change the judges, you're going to wind up getting the same stuff. And I retired in 01 and Ronnie Coleman went on to win another four Olympia titles.
Yeah, you're right. That's a great point because, people talk about, well, if the 1990, they would have kept doing it. You know, we wouldn't have had these guys turn into huge guys like they ended up turning into. But you're right, it's the judging too, because if you go back to 1982 and the years when Zane was winning it from 77 to 79, 1983 when Samir won, those judges preferred or gave credence to guys who had good symmetry, who had good posing, smaller guys like McAway and Samir and Chris Dickerson, where the judging obviously changed then in the 1990s because they were preferring the bigger guys.
Yeah, and it was effective for a little while. The novelty wore off. I think I was the wrong messenger. I was the wrong messenger at the wrong time, trying to warn them that if you keep doing this, it's gonna kill the sport. A lot of people thought I had self-interest about myself, but I was still a fan. I was still a historian. I said, you guys keep doing it, you know, the chickens are gonna come home to roost. And I think we're living in a day and age where. We're living in a day and age where if they had a listen back there, and you know, when I was saying those things, we would have a different quality of sport.
Yeah.
We'd probably have different variety of champions, and it would have been better holistically for everyone. But now we're looking at potentially the extinction of the interest in our sport, because if these guys can – listen, in 3 years, Dexter Jackson will be gone, right? I think Cedric McMillan will probably be gone. I think Sean Roden will be gone. I know for a fact Phil Heath will be gone. The whole landscape will change. And where is the future coming from? Where is the future coming from? Our national champions, our USA champions, the quality and the depth, it's just not there. I used to know where these guys are coming from because they were coming out of the teenage years. They were coming out of the junior nationals. They were coming out of these other state shows, and now you just don't see it. So that's why I say classic physique may be the wave of the future, because we're starting to really take a look how good they are. Robert Timm, Breon Ansley. I mean, look at Jeremy Bundia in the physique division. I mean, these guys are becoming household names.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Rolly Winklers and the Big Rommies and Dexter Jackson and Sean Roden, they may be able to carry the torch for another couple of years, but when they're gone, where are we at? Who are we dealing with?
That's a great point.
All right, and then continuing with the 1990 Mr. Olympia discussion, we also had a chance to talk to Rich Gaspari, and Rich Gaspari was also competing in the Mr. Olympia that year. Rich had a great career in bodybuilding. He took third place at his first Mr. Olympia in 1985 at only, I think, 22 years old. And then in 1986, 87, and 88, Rich took second place to Lee Haney. So 3 years in a row, he was second place. And then in 89... I believe he dropped down to fourth place when it was held in Italy. And now here in 1990, Rich dropped down to fifth place. But we had a great talk with Rich where we talked not only about the 1990 Mr. Olympia, but we also talked about his whole career, how he started bodybuilding, how he moved to California. And in this part of the clip that we're going to talk, that we're going to listen to right now, Rich talks about training with Lee Haney back in 1984 when Rich was training for the Nationals. He was not a pro yet, and he competed in the MPC Nationals the year before, and he took fifth place in the heavyweight class. So he needed to really change the look of his body because he was only 5'8" and competing as a heavyweight, and he looked a little blocky. He had really huge legs, a thick waist, and he was going to have a hard time beating these bigger heavyweights looking like that. So what he decided to do was change his whole philosophy on training, go down to a light heavyweight. And so Rich talks about the changes he made to his training with the help of Lee Haney. So here we go. Hey, Rich, talk a little bit about how you changed your training a little bit when you started training with Lee back in 83. And you were getting ready for 84. He was getting ready for the Olympia. But I think you knew that you had to change the look of your physique, come down to light heavyweight, because you said, I remember your legs were really big over your upper body and you were a little bit blocky. So you had to change the whole look of the symmetry of your physique in order to be successful.
Yes. And, you know, reading a lot about like Arnold, basically, you know, bodybuilding is body sculpting. You know, when you listen to that, you know, and Pumping Iron, he goes, you know, you look at your body, assess it, and then basically assess what you need to do to really get yourself to look, you know, to look better to win shows. And, you know, that's what I did when I was in, you know, 83, coming in, winning the junior nationals and then coming fifth in the nationals. I looked at the pictures and what I noticed is my legs were very big because I had really strong legs. I mean, I was able to squat 85, and, you know, I followed bodybuilders like Tom Platz, and I would duplicate anything Tom Platz did that I ever read in the magazines. I made sure I could do the same. You know, whatever he did, I would do. And I, you know, later I found out that he didn't necessarily do all those crazy lifts, but I would do whatever he did. So, but I looked at my, assessed my physique. My legs were too blocky from all the heavy lifting from squats. I did have a small waist, but because I had a little bit of a, you know, a wider, say, bone structure. So, but my obliques developed very easily, you know, in doing anything I did. So I used to do weighted abs and stuff, and I needed to slim down my waist. I needed to cap my delts, put more size on my chest and back. So when I looked at training, you know, for the Nationals, I said, okay, I need to basically redistribute my weight and bring my legs down, bring my shoulders, my upper body up, bring my waist down. And I did change. What I did is I did a lot more higher reps when it came to legs, lighter weights. I didn't focus. I stopped doing squats completely because I felt squats were an exercise and deadlifts were an exercise. Although great building exercises, they really made you have a blocky type of physique because, you know, it's kind of a core exercise. When you're doing a deadlift, you're going to use your obliques, lower back, you know, squats as well. You're going to use those. And I said, well, I got to stop doing that. I got to slim my legs down, you know, develop, you know, my hamstrings more. So I did more leg press, you know, hack squats, leg extensions, but, you know, much lighter weights. Where Lee, when I was training with Lee, he was going heavier because he wanted to get his legs bigger because his legs were kind of his weak point. Yeah. And then with Lee, I focused on really honing in on training a body. Like I said, I was more of a power lifter, and a lot of my lifts were kind of like sloppy. You know, I lifted maybe not with rigid form a lot of times, you know, squeezing the muscle. So, you know, with Lee, kind of, you know, I reassessed my training, watching him train. Everything with him was very, you know, methodical and squeezing a muscle. And I, you know, like I said, that one thing, you know, he always said, stimulate, don't annihilate. I took that and, you know, really focused on building chest and developing it. Doing more when I, you know, shoulders, I did a lot of presses, overhead presses, thought that was great for shoulders, but really, it was the lateral movements that I focused on. And the lateral movements on my delts, you know, helped me really cap my delts. And I got really, and I'm still very good at side laterals because I could still do 80-pound laterals. You know, I mean, I swing them a little bit, but I still handle that weight where I do it in form where my thumbs are down, my pinkies are up, my elbows are higher, and really focus on the medial head of the delt to really cap those delts. And that's through the lateral movements that most people think, I'm going to do a lot of shoulder presses. No, it's the lateral movement. Right. And then focus on back thickness, the low rows, barbell rows, those type of exercises. And, you know, with abdominal training, very high reps, really trying to stay away from doing anything for obliques. And another thing I did is when I told you I moved to California, I was 255. I said, well, I'm big. And Lee Haney was 255, but he was 6 foot or 5'11". But he goes, you're fat. He goes, you're a fat boy. So I said, you know, I'm not going to be able to see what I'm doing by being this heavy and this bulky. So I started trimming down. I started staying at a lean 220, 215. And then I say that was my like bulk weight preparing for the Nationals. So it was more, like I said, it was a science of really focusing on my weaker body parts, doing less on the stronger body parts, trying to really slim down the waist, really focusing, in which I'm really happy to see on the classic bodybuilding, is vacuums. I did a lot of vacuums because vacuums gave the illusion that your waist was smaller. You know, and I had a way of twisting my waist. When I did any type of pose, I would twist my waist to make my waist look smaller. You know, I didn't really do straight on all the time. And that way it kind of gave the illusion that my waist was slimmer. So those were things that I learned, posing properly to give the illusion that you're, you know, more symmetrical, and just training your body in reassessing what's your weak points, where's your strong points, and just sticking to that focus on what to do to build that. And I think a lot of people don't do that. A lot of bodybuilders, or a lot of people go, they got great arms, they keep training their arms, you know, and they just got great arms and they got skinny legs, you know, you know, or vice versa. So these are things you got to let ego aside and figure out what you're going to do to sculpt your body. Your body is like Arnold would say, it's like a clay statue that you're going to put some muscle here, take away muscle there, and get your body to look the way it should.
All right. And now continuing on again with the 1990 Olympia, we had a chance to talk to Dan Solomon. Now, Dan was not really directly involved with the Mr. Olympia that year, but we talked to Dan because Dan was a associate producer and he really got the ball rolling on a new movie that's about Joe Weider. It's what they call a biopic, where it's a movie about Joe Weider's life. And on this occasion, unfortunately, we had the chance to talk to Dan about the death of Sean Kareem. And Sean was the editor-in-chief of Muscle and Fitness magazine, but he was a friend of mine and a real good friend of Dan's. And he was in the industry and one of the real good guys in the industry. I think he was younger than me. And Sean, unfortunately, found out he had lung cancer that year, last year in 2017. And by the time they found it, it was already at stage 4, and he died only a couple months later. So when I had a chance to talk to Dan, Sean had just passed away, I believe only a few days before that. So unfortunately, we had to talk about that, but we wanted to talk and give some memory to the life of Sean Kareem. So here we go. We got a lot to talk about, but I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about our friend Sean Kareem, who passed away yesterday of all things lung cancer at the young age of, I think he was only 51 years old. And of course, Sean was the editor-in-chief of Muscle and Fitness magazine, and both of us have known Sean for many, many years. In fact, I just did the beginning of my new show, which just aired yesterday, and I was talking about Sean's illness, and the next day when the show aired, he actually passed away. That was quite a shock, wasn't it, Dan?
To say the least. We're still recovering from it. It was, you know, Sean Kareem, really the embodiment of all the things that we love about the bodybuilding and fitness community was all rolled up into him. You know, he is the guy that walked the walk and did it all for the right reasons. Always took a very intelligent and healthy approach, so we thought, right, to all the things that he did in his life. Really just a great physique, a highly intelligent guy, just, you know, exuded such a level of passion and high integrity, and just a real high character guy. And he's somebody that, you know, like you, I've known him for a couple decades, and we both kind of came into this game together. He got a job as a sort of an entry-level writer for Flex Magazine. Mm-hmm. He was actually discovered by a mutual friend of ours, Greg Merritt, who's also a very accomplished writer in this industry. He's written books. He's also a senior level writer at the Weider publications. And he actually stumbled upon Sean Kareem. Sean had a website called Iron Age, which I know probably a lot of your listeners in particular are very familiar with. Sean created this website, and his writing was at such an unusually high level that when Greg Merritt, who was working for Flex Magazine at the time, when he stumbled upon Sean's work. He immediately alerted Peter McGuff, the editor-in-chief and the boss of that magazine. He alerted Peter and said, Peter, if you're looking for a great writer, this is somebody you might want to bring in. So they gave Sean a job, and of course, the rest is history. He would end up one day climbing to the very top of his field, holding the same position that a couple of his mentors held. One guy named Joe Eater, the other guy named Peter McGuff. Sean Perrine would assume that spot and would just do a brilliant job at it. But on a personal note, it's a massive loss. We've been very emotional this last 24 hours since we got wind of it. Myself and Bob Ciccarello and Greg Merritt and many of us were just so close to Sean, and we were brothers. We really were. We had a real meaningful connection, and it was just such a wonderful energy when we were all together, and it was always so pure and fun, and it was one of the parts of going to an event that I know personally I really looked forward to, and it was as close to family as you're going to get in this crazy circus of bodybuilding that we're all a part of, and to lose Sean is just a massive blow, and we're just so distraught about it. And I know, you know, for his family, I can't even imagine what they must be going through. I know he was very close with his mom, and it's just an indescribable loss. And like you said, far, far too young.
Yeah. I was a big fan of the Iron Age website, and I think that's how I met Sean. I think that's how I actually met Peter, because that was in the early 2000s. And again, this was before Facebook, before where the only way you could really communicate with anybody was from the forums. And that website was specifically for old school bodybuilding. So it was a bunch of guys like me and older guys and myself. And we all talked about the days of Arnold and that kind of thing. And that's where we all bonded. And I remember I used to go on that website every day. So Sean was such a great guy. And his writing, like you said, was so great. I mean, he talked about those old days of bodybuilding. I remember he wrote this series of articles about, like, if you were in Gold's Gym when Arnold was training for the 74 Olympia or something like that. And it was great series of articles, and you really felt like you were there. So it was unbelievable.
On some level, John, you're carrying on that tradition of what guys like Peter McGuff started, and we talked about. I was talking to Bob Ciccarello on the phone last night, and we were talking about the important work that you're doing, because guys like Sean Perrine and Peter McGuff, and certainly others, and look, Peter's still around. He's still doing great work, and we still get to enjoy his words every week when he puts out a new article. But I'll tell you, not a lot of people are doing it, and not a lot of people are doing it the right way. And I know Sean would, I know Sean was always very fond of you. And because, look, I always say, people are often quick to call me. They'll always say, yeah, Dan, you're like a historian. And I always say, you think I'm a historian? I got nothing on guys like Sean Perrine and Peter McGuff and John Hansen. And, you guys just take it to a whole nother level, because not only do you guys know as much or more than guys like I do, but you have this thirst to learn more and to sort of capture the essence of those days and to share it with your, with your readers, with your listeners, through your books, through your podcasts, through your articles. And I know Sean would just be so thrilled to know that, somebody like you is carrying it forward. And I hope you don't stop. I hope you continue doing it.
No, thank you. Thank you for saying that, Dan. All right, and then this last clip from the 1990 Mr. Olympia series, we talked to Peter McGuff, and Peter was one of the best writers in the sport of bodybuilding. He worked for Joe Weider's magazine for many years, for Flex magazine, and he also spent some time working for Robert Kennedy's magazine, Muscle Mag International. So in this clip, Peter is talking about the 1990 Mr. Olympia, which he was at in Chicago, and he was attending that show. And Peter also had his own magazine at the time, which he published in England, and he wrote a 10,000-word article about the 1990 Mr. Olympia, because he found it one of the most fascinating Mr. Olympias ever, because there was so much behind-the-scenes drama going on with that contest, with the drug testing and the people who failed and everything like that. So in this clip where I talked to Peter, he talks about how he feels the sport would have changed if they would have used drug testing continuously after 1990 instead of stopping it just after that 1 year. WBF. But if the IFBB said, no, we're committed to this, we're going to keep going with it, how do you think that would have changed the sport of bodybuilding? Because after that, after 1990, that's really when the mass monsters started coming in, and the sport really did change. Because if you look at the bodybuilders from the 70s and even the 80s, we had great bodybuilders in the 80s, but they looked more human, I guess you could say, and they had more of the symmetry aspect. And, you know, you had guys like McAway winning and Samir Banute winning, Frank Zane, of course, in the 70s winning. And then after that, after 1990, everything changed and the guys just started getting so big that guys like smaller guys like that would never have a chance of winning again. So the whole sport really did take a turn. So if they would have continued with the drug test, what changes do you think it would have made?
I've always felt ambivalent about the whole situation of drug test. You know, unfortunately for those bodybuilders who were competing in 1990, mm-hmm. they competed their whole careers without having to worry about a drug test. I also have a background in track and field, and all the current champions, I mean, they've been drug testing for 40 years. You know, the champions of today in the 20s have come through from the beginning knowing they have to pass drug tests. We would have maybe bred a new breed of bodybuilder coming in, youngsters in 1990, you know, amateurs competing in regional shows who then would get to the national level. And from the outset of the career, mainly they'd have to deal with drug testing. And let's be honest, you know, world records continue to be broken. Lance Armstrong won 7 Tour de France's, never failed a drug test. But I have to come back and say, you know, Lance Armstrong won those contests. His dedication won those races. The drugs didn't make him, it wasn't the drugs that pedaled around those, those mountains. You know, it's just another element, and everybody's doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, I went on British television at one time, 20-odd years ago, saying that drug testing should be banned, and they talk about bringing drug testing to level the playing field. Well, it does the opposite. You look at the East Germans in 70s and 80s, it was like a conveyor belt, a factory of producing world-class athletes in track and field. They had doctors, physicists, tests. There was even talk about women being made pregnant because apparently when a woman's been pregnant, she comes back stronger and more resilient and blah, blah, blah. Whereas even in America, you know, track and field athletes had to do this on their own, maybe through a college guy or something. So it's never been a level playing field. The only way to level it is to get rid of steroid testing. Mm-hmm. They're going to get by it anyway. You know, they're always one step ahead. So I'm not sure I've really answered your question, but I think they couldn't take, say, 3 or 4 years of substandard bodies coming through before the new breed came through who'd, you know, started off having to come through drug tests. Mm-hmm. Of course, the way it's gone now, I mean, it's anything goes. And, you know, there's an argument about, well, you know, it's not the sport that we joined. But, you know, it's the human instinct to do, you know, most athletes at the world-class level, you know, sprinters, bodybuilders, whatever, they're almost clinically insane. You know, at the 1976 Montreal Olympics, the athletes were asked in track and field, if we could guarantee you a gold medal, but you'd be dead in 5 years, what would you take? And the majority of them took the gold medal. That's how badly they want it. So they'll do everything. And, you know, I've had to face many journalists, you know, from the mainstream press to blast bodybuilders. I said, okay, you work as reporter for, say, the Sunday Times. What if somebody came along to you and said, I got this substance that will improve your writing, your productivity, you'll end up as the editor of the Sunday Times. Wouldn't you be tempted? And, of course, they said no, but I think we know the answer.
All right, now we're going to move on to season 5, which was the NABBA Mr. Universe. And the NABBA Mr. Universe is a contest rich in history. It started in, I believe, 1940 with John Grimmick winning over Steve Reeves. And throughout the decades, all the top bodybuilders in the world went over to London and competed in the NABBA Mr. Universe, including, of course, Reg Park, Steve Reeves, Bill Pearl, and then Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sergio Oliva competed in it, Frank Zane,
Boyer Coe, Sears New Gray, and the list just goes on and on and on. So Boyer Coe, I believe, won 3 Mr. Universe contests at the NABBA organization, and it was always one of his prized possessions and one of the best memories he had in competing in bodybuilding. But Boyer had an incredible career starting off when he was a teenager. So in this clip, we're going to talk to Boyer about when he was competing as a young man out in Louisiana and some of the experiences he had competing as a teenager. And then when you were 17, you won, what was that show you won? I think it was in Louisiana, and it wasn't a teenage show, it was an open level show, but said there was a huge crowd.
That was the interesting thing. That was the first contest when I was 15, didn't know anything about it, okay? I didn't even have a pair of posing trunks. I just used a pair of swim trunks. So, I mean, I looked ridiculous up there. So I had competed when I was 17. A guy sends me an entry form for the Mr. Louisiana contest about a week before the contest. So okay. I said, okay, I got to try and do this. So go to New Orleans. That's where the contest was held at. And I ended up, have no experience. I ended up placing third, and I won a few body parts. So that was in January. So then May comes with the Mr. New Orleans contest. Now, that was the biggest contest in the entire South. Hmm. And it's also one of the oldest contests in this country. It was started even before the Mr. America.
Wow.
Because I had met a guy when I was a lot younger. He had won a Mr. New Orleans contest, and it was held in 1932.
Wow.
That was well before the Mr. America. So anyway, and that was also the first contest that I won was a Mr. New Orleans. But what was significant about that contest, at the time, it was held at Pontchartrain Beach, which was outdoors, which was a huge amusement park. Okay, so the evening that the opening of the Pontchartrain and amusement park was done, they had a huge amount of people there. That was the largest crowd I'd ever posed to. There was about 15,000 to 20,000 people there. I've never posed to a crowd of people, university things.
People.
Yeah, so that was quite an accomplishment. I did that, I think, I won a contest. And it was right before I graduated from high school. It was about 3 or 4 days before I graduated from high school. So that was quite a satisfaction there.
How did your people in high school, your other students, how did they take to you being a bodybuilder? Because I know I started bodybuilding in the late 70s, and everybody thought it was the weirdest thing ever.
Oh, I was a complete oddity. They didn't know what to do with me. But the interesting thing about it, in going through high school, and I went through high school with a bunch of really badass kids. Everybody thought I was badass because I was so much stronger than everybody else. It wasn't that I was tough or anything, but I got a certain amount of respect just because I was so much stronger than everybody else. So they automatically assumed, wow, if this guy is strong, he must be one bad son of a bitch. And I really wasn't, but nobody messed with me.
And you bench pressed 400 pounds when you were still in high school, right?
Oh, yeah, I did. That was my goal. That's one of the things I wanted to do. I don't know why bench press was so important, but that was one of the things I loved to do. So I made up my mind, I guess when I was about 14, I said, I got to do 400 pounds, basically because way back in those days, there wasn't a whole lot of people really that strong in, you know, or at least I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
In the sport. So I figured, well, if I could do that 400 pounds by the time I got out of high school, that would be a good accomplishment. Much of my stuff was always done by me writing down and setting a goal or a time limit. I had to do this by such and such a time. And then I would sit it and then go about trying to accomplish that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I remember you said you would write that down all the time, 400, 400.
Oh, God, 400. Yeah. Yeah, I got in a lot of trouble in high school from doing that because I carved 400 in my desk. I mean, it was just covered with 400, and they raised so much hell they had to put another desk in the room. I got a lot of trouble for that.
What was the contest you went in? I think it was in Texas where you went out the wrong door when you were getting ready for the show.
Oh, no. That happened in going back to that Mr. Louisiana contest that it was held in January. The interesting thing about that, see, once again, I didn't know who, I had no experience.
Yeah.
So I'm in the pump up room and I'm watching, just watching these other guys copying what they were doing. So trying to keep from looking like a fool. So we're in the pump up room and I'm pumping up, getting ready for the show. All of a sudden I realize I'm the only one left in the pump up room. Everybody else was getting ready to line up to go on stage.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I missed out. So I must be late. So I run out the wrong door. It was held at the YMCA. Mm-hmm. The door slams shut. Okay, so now I'm standing in the alley and nothing but my pulling trunks and baby oil on, and it's cold as hell. It's in January.
Right.
And I'm beating on the door, but no one's in the pump-up room. I can't get back in. So I have to run all the way a block, all the way around the YMCA, wow, and come in through the front door to where the crowd is at.
Right.
I mean, my heart was, I thought it was going to beat through my chest. Okay? So I get right through the front door as they're calling my name. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I make my way, I get up on the stage, you know, and mm-hmm. I mean, of course, nobody's looking at my feet, but my feet were all dirty from running right around the block. So you
had to run through the audience to get back up on the stage.
Well, yeah, but I had to run around a block down the alley and around the front door to get in barefoot,
right,
you know?
Right, right.
So my dad was with me. So after the contest was over, we're driving home the next day. You're just daydreaming, driving back. He says, you know, he said, that was pretty cool. He says, how you came in through the entrance. He said, that surprised a lot of people. I didn't have a heart to tell him that I'd gotten locked out. You know, that's why I had to do it. So he never knew that I was just such a fool that I had to run all the way around the alley to get in the front door to compete in the contest.
That's a classic story. All right. Now, in this clip, Boyer is going to talk to us about competing in the NABBA Mr. Universe for the first time. And it was right after he won the Mr. America contest in 1969. So he talks about his rivalry with Jim Haislop, who won the Mr. America the year before Boyer, and then traveling over to London and all the stuff that happened to him on his trip over to London to compete in the NABBA Mr. Universe for the very first time in 1969. Here we go. Let's talk about 1967. You went into a contest called the Southern States, which is out here in Florida, and your friend Jim Haislop was in that contest, and he took first, and you got second. And you remember that contest?
Yeah. Well, I only went to that contest for one reason, and that's because I found out that Bill Pearl was giving a posing exhibition there.
Okay.
And Bill Pearl was, you know, I've always admired Bill Pearl. He's become an extremely close friend of mine over the years. So I wasn't in that great a shape, but I wanted to go to contest because I wanted to see Bill Pearl. And you're right, Jim Haislop was an excellent bodybuilder. I mean, he beat me like a drum for a couple of years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Every contest we go in, he was first, I was second. It didn't matter where we went, he was always first. In 1968, we go to the Mr. America contest, you know, and I think I'm in pretty good shape, okay? Sure enough, he's there. You know, and everything that happened bad to me, getting there, I lose my luggage, okay? I didn't have my posing trunks. I didn't have nothing.
Okay? Wow.
So I had to go out and either buy a toothbrush and a razor just so I could at least brush my teeth, take a shower. So the next morning I'm thinking, how in the hell am I going to compete? I don't even have, you know, in those days you had to have a suit on and you went for an interview.
Yeah, right.
I had no suit, no posing trunks, so about 30 minutes before the contest started, Red was with me. I said, what the hell am I going to do? He said, well, maybe you can go borrow somebody's posing trunks.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I guess that's what we'll have to do. So about that time, finally a cab shows up. They found our luggage. We got there just in time. So sure enough, go to the contest. It's held in York, Pennsylvania. It's about 105 degrees in that auditorium. I mean, it's like a steam bath. So we're there, we're good, and for some reason, I got the crowd on my side. They were really cheering for me, and I was fortunate. I won most of the body parts. I think I won everything except best abdominals. Never could get, I just didn't have the genetics for good abdominals, but I won everything else and the most muscular, and mm-hmm. Haislop still wins. I'm thinking, Jesus, what the hell's wrong with me, you know? But you see, once again, there was no hard feelings. After the contest was over, we all went out and ate together, you know?
Right.
So then we go next year. I'm fortunate enough to win in 69, okay? But what took place in 69 was far more important than the contest itself. Because what happened, the day before I had to leave to go, I'm working out with a guy in the gym, and he put some rosin on his hands, mm-hmm. you know, to get a better grip. Well, he's spotting me. I'm on the bench press. Some of the stuff comes off his hands and falls into my eye.
Hmm.
Okay, so it starts bothering my eye, and I don't really take care of it. I'm trying to get ready to go to the contest. So by the time I get to New York, I'm telling Dennis, I said, you know, I said, my eye's really bothering me. I still don't do nothing about it.
Right.
So we catch an overnight flight. We leave New York and we land in London, I guess, about 6:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. By the time I get to the hotel, I can't see out of my eye anymore. Thinking, my God, this, and it's swollen up.
Wow.
So I check into the hotel. I said, I got to do something. So I get a cab, and I told the cab driver, I said, look, can you take me to the nearest hospital? So we dropped me off, and luckily I found a doctor. He cleans my eye out, and yeah, I can see again. It feels good. But he says, okay, you got to wear this patch over your eye for 24. I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't want to look like a pirate. But So he puts his patch on my eye, so then I got to go back to the hotel. By that time, all the other competitors are there. So here's a guy who's the current Mr. America, and they think, hell, he's only got one eye, you know? So I said, oh, man. So then I became friends with some of the guys from England, like Frank Richards was a great guy.
Yeah,
Frank, great bodybuilder. Those guys were extremely friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So we go out this night, and the night before the contest, I said, well, look, let's go over to Wag Bennett's house. He's a party over there.
Mm-hmm.
So, killing time, I go. So I keep running into things because I can't see good. I only got one eye. So I said, this is embarrassing. So I finally, I guess about midnight, took the eye patch off and threw it away, and then I could see all right, you know.
And it ended up working good because you won the contest. You won your class, and you won the overall in your first NAVA Universe.
And the funny thing about that contest was after the contest was over with, okay, so what you do, you go from the old Royal Hotel, which mm-hmm. was really run-down hotel, but, hell, you didn't care, you know. You go from the coach would pick you up, bring you to the contest, and then bring you back to the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all I had on was my warm-up suit and my posing trunk and my little workout bag. So I didn't think to take any money with me. So the contest is over with, and I won, and I'm thrilled to death that I won. This is a great accomplishment. And I finally beat Jim Haslam.
Yeah.
After him beating me for 2 years, you know.
Right, he won the tall class, and you won the medium class.
Yeah, so, and then Franco won the short class.
Right.
So, the guy told us, you know, after the contest is over, you go out of the stage door and the bus will be parked, you know, a block down.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking my time. I'm going out, and there's an old gentleman there. I guess it was kind of the manager. So I said, I noticed when I went outside, it had all the streets blocked off. So I said, well, what's going on? I said, well, what's happened here? The guy says, oh, it's just, everybody's waiting to see the new Mr. Universe winner. I said, you mean people are waiting to see people? I said, yeah. I said, man, they all raised and held him and shake my hands. So I was overjoyed. I got so involved in that. The bus took off and left me, okay? And I didn't have any money, so I couldn't catch a cab.
Right.
So I had to walk all the way back from where the Prince Albert Hall, I think was, back to the hotel. And I've always had a pretty good sense of direction, so I kind of figured out where the hotel was at. But it wouldn't have mattered. I could have walked back barefoot. It didn't make any difference to me.
Right. You were so happy.
Because I was so happy. So later that night, we all go out. We're going to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
So Frank Richard and a bunch of his buddies from England were in this bar. So Frank and I get up to go to the bar to order drinks for, there must have been 7 or 8 guys. So we're standing at the bar talking, and right next to Frank and I, but on Frank's side of the bar, were 2 lesbians, okay? So all of a sudden, they get in this hellacious fight. They're fighting and throwing drinks everywhere, and they throw a drink all over Frank's suit, and he's pissed. Okay? So he immediately grabs one of them. Well, when he grabs one, okay, the second one turns on Frank, and she jumps on Frank's back, and she's clawing him all up. So I grab her and pull him off of him,
right.
And as I spin around, I see the strangest thing I have ever seen in my life until this day. I don't know if you've ever seen people who have, and I'm trying to think of the correct name, they call it a werewolf syndrome. It's called hypotrichosis. In other words, it's people where they grow hair for whatever reason all over the body. Their face and everything is covered. Everything. Mm-hmm. It looks like a werewolf. Okay, when I spin around and pull this girl off of Frank's back, this guy is standing right in front of me. Scares the living shit out of me. I'm thinking, my God, what the hell is going on? I thought it was a werewolf, you know?
It was Lon Chaney.
Well, what? This guy was the bouncer in the place.
Really?
He grabbed those 2 lesbians. He just smashes their heads together and drags them out of the place. So now he wasn't able to talk. He couldn't talk.
Really? Wow.
And he comes back in, and he made us understand. Made Frank and I understand. He wanted to thank us for breaking the thing up because they were just breaking glass. I told Frank, I said, you know, I think it's time for us to get the hell out of here. But that, and you know, it's funny, after I saw that, I thought about it for a long time. There's only 50 or so people in the world that have that rare condition.
Really? Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's very, very unusual. And this was happened to be one of them.
He was right there.
Oh, wow. God. I'm telling you, that was, like I said, the events leading up to and after the contest were much more eventful than the contest itself.
All right. Now, in this clip, we are going to talk to John Brown. And John Brown won the NAVA Mr. Universe twice. And he competed later than Boyer Coe and Arnold did. He was competing in the 1980s. And John Brown, of course, was unique because he developed a unique posing style where he did some type of dancing and pop lock. And no one had ever seen that before John Brown did it. But in addition to John Brown's own personal victories, he was also very influential in the careers of other people, including Sean Ray, Melvin Anthony, and Vince Taylor. So in this clip, John talks about how when he trained his students, he would not only train them physically, but he would also train them mentally. And he talks here about the mental strategies he uses for the people that he mentored to be their best that they could be.
See, my training is not just physical. It's also mental training. Mm-hmm. One example, you know, Melvin, when I first met Melvin, he said, John, man, everyone makes fun of my hamstrings or my legs. I said, don't worry about it. So I made him make a collage of biceps, quads, triceps, and you make a collage and bring it to me. And he did that. He said, this is how I want my legs to look. And he had the picture of this gentleman's name. I forgot his name. Mike something, but he has a great leg. I said, okay, I want you to look at that picture every night before you go to bed and you study it. I want you to know everything about that picture. And when we're training, I would say, okay, pull the pictures up. You got the pictures up? Can you see them? Yeah, I see them. Okay, they would have numbers. If you say if you want his legs, his quads to be 29 inches. I said, okay, you got the number? Yeah, okay, say it out loud. I want to have 29 inch thighs. And you got the picture? Yeah, okay, now go. Now we train. But we never did a set without pulling the pictures and the numbers up. Never.
Wow. And so that's awesome.
And that was the mental training I taught them.
Yeah.
So it was not just physical. So there's a lot to my training than just not just training. That's just that's dumb. So you know, I believe that the mind works everything. If I don't have my brain inside of my skull, I can't move and get up and walk away. In order for me to walk away, I must first tell myself mentally in my brain to tell my limbs to move. So without my brain, my limbs don't move. So that meant to me, my brain, I need to do so many reps for my brain. I'm doing reps for my bicep. Well, how many reps am I doing with my brain? So I taught them how to do mental reps, verbal reps. So this is mind training. So I trained their mind, and Melvin's legs became just like the picture here. It was Mike Francois was the guy he took a picture of. His quads end up looking just like Mike Francois. He was tripped out on that. It's because you trained your mind. You see,
that's
so
wild.
It wasn't just, it's not just physical training we're doing. This is what guys don't understand. So that's why I was able to train these guys all the same way. I just put different orders in mentally. If they had a, you know, I don't know, weak bicep or whatever, mentally I taught them how to train to make that become their strong point.
It's interesting you say that, because I remember Sean, in some of the articles he wrote, he said he would look at Bertel Fox's chest and Arnold's biceps, and he had that, you know, vision in his mind of he would pick the best guys for each body part, and he would think about that when he was training.
That's where it came from me. I taught him that.
Yeah. Did you use that with your sons too, John?
Oh, yes. My sons, man, we do it when we train. Even before a game, I go, look, don't go into a game without knowing how many touchdowns you're going to get. How many you want? I want 3. Okay, you got to say that all night. All night in the bed, you say it out loud. Tomorrow, I'll make 3 touchdowns. And it'll manifest.
You have to
mentally put an order in, and it'll manifest in your life. So I taught my sons that, too. And people see my sons, they go, how did you get 3 sons? So smart. They took the SAT in 3 different languages. How'd you get that? How'd you do that? But I do a lot of mental training. It's not just all physical.
Right. I just did an interview with Boyer Coe, and he said that he wanted to bench press 400 pounds before high school ended. So he said he would write down 400 all day on a piece of paper. He said he even scratched it into his desk at school, and he got in a lot of trouble because they had to take his desk away and replace it with another desk because he scratched in 400 in his desk. But that's just another example of mental visualization.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's another thing I taught you guys. And then next you know, it happened, you know?
Yeah.
I remember Cynthia Hill was doing the Galaxy contest. What that is, there was an obstacle course she had to run.
Yeah,
and it was
I remember
in Mexico
that.
Or something. It was in Mexico, and she was – I trained her, and she wanted me to come. I couldn't. And I said, don't worry about it. And so there's a time, and they kind of time you on it. She called me up crying after her first heat. John, I run – I don't know, it was 108 or something. I said, okay, calm down. What's the best time? She said, the best time is 104 or something. I said, okay. She said, I got 2 more heats to run. I said, okay, listen to me. You know how we do it. You need to run 403. You go, hang up the phone, and go by yourself and just pace up and down the walkway and just say, my next heat will be 403. My next heat will be 403. My next heat would be 403. She did that. She called me back crying. She ran 403 and she won. I said, it's mental.
Yeah.
You know what to do. I don't need to be there. I taught you what to do. It's all mental.
Right. Yeah, so that's amazing.
There's a lot to this training than meets the eye.
All right. Now we're going on to season 6, which was our last season before we just started our new season of season 7. So in season 6, we talked about the Larry Scott years, and these were the years of 1965, 1966, when Larry Scott won the very first Mr. Olympia in 1965. So there was a lot going on those years because the IFBB would hold the Mr. Olympia with the IFBB Mr. America, the Mr. World, and the Mr. Universe. So there were some really great bodybuilders competing on stage, and this was really the beginning of the IFBB when it really started to gain prominence and eventually take over NABBA and become the number one organization in the world, in the bodybuilding world. So in this clip, we're going to talk to Dave Mastorakis, who was one of the top amateur bodybuilders in the 1970s. But what's unique about Dave is that he was a competitor in the 1965 and 66 Mr. Olympia competitions. He wasn't in the Mr. Olympia, but he was in the Mr. America portion. But Dave was only 15 years old when he competed in 1965. And somehow he got a way to compete in that contest at only 15 years old. But Dave was also a really close friend of Mike Mentzer. So in this clip, we're going to talk to Dave about his friendship with Mike, how he got to meet Mike, and how he started using the heavy-duty training techniques that Mike did, the high-intensity training, into his own training and how it really changed his life as a bodybuilder. So, Dave, before we start talking about the contest more, tell us a little bit more about your career, because I mentioned I saw you in the late 70s. But I know you're good friends with Mike Mentzer, and you had a pretty extensive career, competitive-wise.
Well, Mike met me, or heard of, saw me at the contest. And
that's right. He was there, right? He was watching.
Right. He was in the audience, and he's savvy enough to know that Ed Jubenville was from Massachusetts, so he wrote to Ed, and he said, I don't know if you know this gentleman personally, but I was just saw him at the Miss America. Do you know his address? So, again, the way Ed is, rather than get back to Mike, he sent it to me. He said, This gentleman could be a future pen pal for you. He says he's the same age as you are, and he was at the contest.
Yeah.
So we became friends almost immediately. And the following summer, I think, I went to his house, and he got me in touch with John Grimmick and sent a few pictures with John. And, I mean, at the time, I was a little bit ahead of Mike. That's all I can say. But a few years later, he caught up very quickly. And so he was one of the reasons I got into the MD for the Dennis Tenorino was on the cover.
Okay.
And it was in 1967, and the article was entitled Meet the Teenage Hercules. And
wow,
sat down with John, and they took a bunch of photos of me in the New York Barbell.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a good experience. And like I said, we became friends until Mike passed, really, unfortunately, about 11 years ago. No, wait a minute. My God, it's about 17 years. I can't believe it.
Yeah, it's 2000, right? Something like that? 2001?
Yeah, it was June. I think it's June 11th or 2001, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2001.
Right. What was Mike like as a teenager? You said you were a little bit ahead of him when you met him, but he had those great genetics, so he probably looked pretty good even as a teenager, right?
Oh, God. The irony of it is that I went there, he was like, you know, I would say like my fan. And by the time I left her, I was his fan. You know?
Right.
He had great potential, you know, real tiny waist. His arms were good. His legs were very good. Mm-hmm. And there are pictures that I have of him as a teenager, and he just excelled him until, you know, he basically went into the Army. He continued to improve, or not the Army, the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
But he really was a huge fan of bodybuilding. I mean, all guys, all magazines, he read everything. He's a ferocious reader. He really was a big fan of Bill Pearls. And in 75, we went to the Mr. America in Los Angeles, and we got a ride to Bill's gym in Pasadena where he wanted to meet Bill. And unfortunately, Bill was out of town at the time. So I don't know. I'm sure they met eventually, but I wasn't there during that meeting. But you know, he was a big fan of everybody's.
And then he competed in the Mr. America the year Casey won, right? I think he took 10th place.
Yeah.
In 71.
That was the turning point. At that point, I had kind of decided I wasn't going to compete anymore. I didn't want to train like everybody was training split programs. I was trying to get a normal life.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I couldn't move to California. And I said, you know, I'm not going to get on drugs. And so Mike was in the Air Force, and he was getting ready to compete in the America. He calls me up and he says, Dave, I found out a new way to train. And I mean, what are you talking about? He said, we're not training right. We're overtraining. We're not training hard enough. We're training too long. And I said, well, what are you talking about? I said, well, I was at the Mr. America and I bumped into Casey Viator. And I said, wait, you were at the Mr. America? He says, yeah. I said, how'd you do? I came in 10th, but that's not important. I want to talk to you about the training. We're not doing it right. And he was so excited about the training. And he had met Arthur Jones, and that was, you know, his beginning of the revelation as far as proper training. And I said, well, let me give it a shot, you know. And this was like 1971, I believe.
Yeah.
And I started training under that method without the equipment. We didn't have any Nautilus equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And 3 years later, I took third Mr. America. So.
Wow, really?
It was inspirational, yeah.
Yeah. So you said you guys didn't have Nautilus equipment, so you just did it with free weights? You just did really heavy training?
There was no Nautilus was so expensive. The gyms really couldn't afford it. And so until there was one available, we just used what we had.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if if Mike had access to it either. I'm not sure. I'm not sure until he moved to Florida for a while after he got out of the Air Force.
Oh, really?
His first time he used the Nautilus and actually trained with Arthur Jones.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. So give us an example of how you would do that, Dave. Like if like for chess, for example, how did you change your workouts to do the lower volume?
What we used to do the incline, flat benches and dips and flies and cable crossovers, right? That's what would be a normal pec workout.
Okay.
From what we did from there is we do we do flies, regular flies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And jump on the floor and do some push-ups, and then get up and do a couple of benches. And then that would be the set. I mean, max failure each, maybe about 20 seconds between each one.
Okay.
And that was it. The whole pec workout would take about 90 seconds to 2 minutes.
Wow.
And that was a big change.
Yeah.
I saw immediate results.
Really? Wow. How many total sets was that then? Just like
it would be like three. About three sets.
Uh-huh.
And if you wanted to add some weight to the dips or, do the bench, the order was really, at the time, just random. Always start off with an isolated motion, then go to compound movement.
Okay.
So bench press or I like close grip push-ups ending up on the floor,
Yeah. All right. And finally, our last clip of the day for our special anniversary show, which is part two, we are going to talk to Jerry Branum. And Jerry Branum is always one of my entertaining guests because he's got a lot of great stories and a great guy. But Jerry goes way back, and Jerry was also in attendance at the 1966 Mr. Olympia contest. So he has some really, really good stories of that show. He was living in New York at the time. He was brought up in New York and Brooklyn. He's a great storyteller, and he's a really funny guy. Jerry used to write for Joe Weider's magazine for many years for Muscle and Fitness and Flex. And he also wrote for Iron Man magazine, and that's where I got to meet Jerry because I wrote for Iron Man for many years myself. So in this clip, Jerry's going to talk about the Mr. Olympia competitors, including Sergio and Harold Poole and also Larry Scott. Larry Scott had one of the most amazing ovations of any bodybuilder anywhere in the history of the sport that night in 1966. So Jerry's going to try and put it into words what he experienced watching that contest. Here we go. So how did Sergio look in this lineup, Jerry, in the Mr. Olympia after winning the Mr. World? Did he freak everybody out? Because I always heard that Larry Scott sort of announced his retirement because he saw Sergio. Was Sergio intimidating?
Sergio did freak everybody out. And to tell you the truth, there was some grumbling in the audience. No, the consensus of the people there was that Larry Scott deserved to win because Larry was the king of bodybuilders. He had this aura about him. Nobody questioned his win. But there was a little grumbling at the contest about Sergio's placing. They felt that he should have been, at least third. What did he get, by the way?
It doesn't really say, but it looks like from the way they're listing it, I thought Chuck Sipes was fourth, Sergio was third, Harold Poole was second, and then Larry was the winner.
Okay, maybe he did get third. Okay, that would be about right, but in other words, I would suggest, and again, this is just speculation on my part, I would suggest that because, remember, this was Sergio's first major IFBB competition, and although he was well-known in bodybuilding from his previous AAU participation, this is his first competition, and it's almost like you have to earn your way up.
Yeah.
So, the highest he could have placed in this show, he was against two veterans.
Yeah.
Larry Scott and Harold Poole. This was the best he could have done at this particular contest. There's no way they were going to give him the title in his very first IFBB contest. I mean, they already gave him the Mr. World that night.
Yeah.
So, they're not going to give him the Mr. Olympia, too. So third place for him was almost like a victory. That's the highest he could have gotten, I would suggest.
No, I take it back. I'm looking at muscle memory now, and it says he got fourth. He did get fourth. Chuck Sipes got third.
Okay, all right. That's what I thought. Yeah, that was where the grumbling was. Some people felt that that Sergio should have beaten Chuck Sipes. That was the only contentious issue of that contest. Personally, I still would have given Chuck over. I would have had, because Chuck was in tremendous peak shape. He didn't have Sergio's genetics, V-shape, small waist, and all that, but he was in tremendous shape. He was a veteran. He had won the Mr. World, Mr. Universe. I personally, still would have had Chuck there. This is Sergio's first contest, a major Olympia. I felt that, you know, fourth place was still pretty good for him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about Harold Poole? Tell me your observations.
Oh, Harold Poole I knew very well. I knew Harold Poole from I met him in Mid-City Gym. He also trained there in New York. You know, Harold, again, was a phenomenon, again, similar to, he had a similar story to Sergio in that he started out in the AAU, got a couple of bad decisions at the 1962 mm-hmm. AAU America. He lost to a guy named Joe Benda. Joe, great guy, terrific guy from New York. But, you know, he wasn't up to Sergio's development. Harold Poole. Harold Poole was already ripped even back then, and he stood out among all bodybuilders.
Yeah.
He was originally from Indiana. He was one of the greatest teenage athletes in the country. Very few people know that. He was a track star in multiple sports, and then he went into bodybuilding. He already had a physique by the time he went into bodybuilding. He already looked like a bodybuilder.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a natural segue. So he started competing in 1959, I believe. You know, he competed in the AAU. Again, you know, I wasn't there, so I couldn't tell you, but, you know, he got a couple of bad breaks. He did win some titles, but when it came to, like, the Mr. America, he always got, he was always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
Yeah.
A lot of people say it was because he was a black man, you know, and
mm-hmm.
Again, I'm sure that's possible. I really don't know, but he got sick of it, too, and he went into the IFBB, just like, you know, he wound up winning Mr. America, Mr. Universe in short order, and then, of course, there was the Mr. Olympia. In the first year, I believe, 65, you might need to correct me on this, I think he also got second to Larry Scott.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
That was the very first Mr. Olympia. But I knew Harold Poole quite well. He was I was a young kid at Mid-City. I was only 14 years old. Harold was so friendly, so warm. He spoke with a bit of a, he had a stutter when he spoke, but mm-hmm. just the sweetest, nicest guy. I still remember how nice he was to me.
Mm-hmm.
There was an incident that I almost hesitate to say this, you know, but I got to say it anyway. At that 1966, remember, I knew Harold Poole. I was a friend of his.
Okay.
I was standing backstage after the contest. I was standing with Harold Poole, and I don't know if you remember this guy. There was a guy from New Jersey who was a good friend of Harold Poole. His name was Mike Jubillo. This guy was about 6'3",
mm-hmm.
and he had his arms. He used to wear, like, big sweaters. His shoulders, his arms were just gigantic. He was so big that he made Sergio look like a baby.
Wow.
This guy looked like he was rumored to have 23-inch arms, and I'm not kidding.
Wow, no kidding.
This guy was gigantic. I was standing backstage with Mike Jubillo, who I didn't really know very well, but I knew Harold, and we were just standing there. Larry Scott had just beaten Harold at the Olympia,
mm-hmm.
and I was standing there with these two guys. And a kid came up to Harold and asked for an autograph, and Harold readily signed, you know. And the kid said thanks and walked away. Larry Scott saw this, comes up to me, Jubillo, and Harold Poole, bends over, and you know, like he sticks his behind out, and says to Harold, "Harold, sign this."
Wow.
And Harold was such a sweet guy that he just laughed. But
yeah.
Mike Jubillo was, again, from New Jersey. He was a tough guy type. He was a bouncer, as a matter of fact. And he started to go towards Larry. He was going to break Larry Scott. No, people don't know this. Larry Scott almost lost his life that night. And he, I don't think he even knows it himself.
Wow.
But this guy was going to go and beat the shit out of Larry Scott right there.
Wow.
But Harold stopped him. You know, he says, "Don't worry about it. It's okay. Larry's a nice guy. He's just joking around." You know, and he calmed Mike Jubillo down, and nothing happened. But I'll never forget that.
Wow.
And I remember looking at this guy. I don't think a freaking Sherman tank could have stopped this guy, Mike Jubillo. He was just gigantic, and you know, God knows what this. He had these huge hands.
Mm-hmm.
One punch, and that would have been the end of Larry Scott's life.
But
so Larry Scott had no idea. You know, Larry, I got to know Larry later on, and I don't want to give the wrong impression.
Mm-hmm.
Larry was a little bit arrogant in those days. You know, he knew he was the king of bodybuilding.
Right.
You know, when you get to know Larry, he was a very nice guy. You know, I don't want to create the wrong impression. Larry, especially as he got older, he mellowed out more or less, and he's a super nice guy. I mean, I'm so sorry that he passed away, sadly, from the Alzheimer's disease, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was just like, Larry just meant it as a joke. It wasn't meant, you know, to put Harold down. That's the way Larry was in those days, a little bit of a joker, you know. But that was an incident that happened. But you know, Harold Poole's physique, I can tell you, was fantastic. He was actually much bigger than Larry. You know, he was muscular. He was harder than Larry. But unfortunately, Larry had the aura. He had the, you know, he had the momentum, let's say. He had already won it the year before. And, you know, it was an uphill battle for Harold, you know. And quite frankly, even though you could say I'm not objective, I'll say it anyway, I felt, and I still remember after the contest commenting on this, I felt that it could have gone either way. In other words, if you judged, what I'm trying to say, John, if you judge purely by physique, I would have, honestly, I mean, again, you accuse me of being non-objective, I you know, but I felt that Harold should have won that night because he was in harder shape. He had more body parts. Larry basically had shoulders and arms, and that's it. I mean, he had no back development. Larry, you know, Harold had good back development. Harold had much better abs. Harold had much better legs. You know, Larry had the shoulder. You know, Harold's shoulders were comparable to Larry's, but Larry had him on the arms. But you know, it was Larry's aura and I don't know how to put it, his mystique that won the show. I mean, there was just no way anybody on earth could have beaten Larry Scott that night. And then the thing I remember about Larry, you know, I know you're going to ask me about him, but the thing I'll always remember, and I talked about this with Larry himself, I'll never forget the reception that Larry Scott got when they announced, you know, the other guys had already posed, you know, Sergio and, you know, Chuck and here's and Harold. And then, you know, they announced, and from Studio City, California, Larry Scott, and the audience went berserk. Everybody stood on their feet. What I didn't know was there was a young Lou Ferrigno in the audience, too, that night. He told me later on. Everybody stood on their feet and was screaming and yelling. And, you know, 5 minutes go by, 8 minutes go by, and we're all still screaming, Larry, no Larry, way. Larry. And there's no Larry. After about maybe 12 minutes, suddenly from the left side of the stage, the first glimpse you had was the lights on this platinum blonde hair. It looked platinum, not blonde, platinum. Slowly, step by step, here comes Larry Scott. As soon as he appeared, it was like pandemonium. I mean, the screaming went on. And if I remember correctly, it went on throughout his pose. Every pose he did, it reached a crescendo, just screaming. Larry, I mean, it was like, this went on, John, believe it or not, for 20 minutes.
Holy
from the
shit.
Time they announced his name all the way through his posing, 20 minutes. And I remember in a telephone conversation years later with Larry, I said, Larry, you know, one thing I'll never forget was that reception you got at the 66 Olympia.
Right.
I said, do you remember? He said, I sure do remember that. He says, believe me, I was as surprised as everybody else. He says, I couldn't believe in myself. He goes, you know, I mean, it was just absolutely tremendous. And, you know, he posed, I mean, he did all those, you know, his posing routine, the twisting shot. Every time he flexed those famous arms, oh, my God, the audience went absolutely berserk. And, you know, and then, of course, you know, the rest, they announced him as the winner. Mm-hmm. And that's when he announced his retirement. He went to the to the podium, but you know the year before, which I wasn't at, they put this kind of crown on his head,
like the margarine crown.
Yeah, and I don't think they did it the second year. I don't remember them putting a crown at the 60s.
Because I think they just gave him that plate with the $1,000.
Yeah, they gave him a plate with some fake money on it, if I remember correctly.
Right.
But I remember him telling me that when they put that crown, he said exactly what you just said. He said, I thought I was in a margarine commercial, you know, when he put that silly-looking crown on his head, you know.
So it sounds like he had a bit of a showman in him, like holding off till he came out.
I think that's what he did, you know. I should have asked him about that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'll never forget it. I'm thinking, where is this guy? I mean, like 10 minutes go by before he walked, and he walked so slowly across the stage, every step. I mean, there was a famous bodybuilder in that same show that year. Might have been Rock Stonewall, I think. I can't remember who it was, who had that same thing. It took him like 8 minutes to get from the side of the stage to the posing dais. He walked so slowly. But in his case, the audience got pissed off because right. he wasn't Larry Scott. See, right. they'll accept that from Larry Scott, but not from this guy.
Right.
You know, the Brooklyn audience, you know, they didn't hold anything back. They'd be, hey, move your ass! What are you trying to do? Get on the podium! They were yelling out. They were annoyed at this guy. But yeah. when Larry Scott did it, they loved it.
Yeah.
It's amazing, you know? I still remember that.
I've had so many people on the show, and we talk about the old days, and we talk about how exciting it was and the atmosphere, how loud the crowds were, and it's hard to explain it to today's, you know, the younger kids today, because it's just not the same. But it was crazy back then, right?
Well, nothing comparable today to then.
Yeah.
Nothing comparable. But, you know, I think of it, a lot of it has to do with, again, the fact that there was no internet. There
right.
was nothing.
Right.
There was no YouTube video. I mean, you know, all we saw was the magazines, and just the sheer excitement of seeing these guys in person was just absolutely incredible to us. And, in fact, there was an incident backstage. This is, again, something that never got in the magazine. Not backstage, but after the show, there was a funny incident that happened. I can tell you that I don't believe this was ever written up in the magazine. What happened was these guys, all of them, you know, were such stars to the fans that after the show, they all gathered at the side of the Brooklyn Academy of Music, the stage door entrance. There must have been about 300 people standing in the street waiting for the bodybuilders to come out through the door. I mean, there's a scene in Pumping Iron where you can see Arnold walking in through that same door where he's carrying that, you know, that painting of him.
Right.
You know, that was, he was going for that same door. That was the same door he's heading
for.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, that was the stage door entrance. So after the 66 show, there was about 300 fans in the street waiting for the bodybuilders to come out. And I remember, you know, Dave Draper, they mobbed Dave Draper when he came out. Oh, you know, they were all over him. Dave, you know, Dave was a good sport about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, then the California guys got Gabe Boudreaux and, you know, Donald, all these guys came out. And, you know, they all got the same reception. And, again, and finally, who comes out? There's Joe Weider comes out with Larry Scott, right? Mm-hmm. And the audience went berserk. And, you know, I was standing there. And I still remember fearing for Larry Scott's life.
Wow. Because
they were literally jumping on him and tearing at his clothes.
Jesus, really?
And
wow.
And it was hilarious because Joe Weider was trying to use his body to shield Larry Scott. I mean, imagine Joe in this suit was like, he had his arms wrapped around Larry Scott trying to pull him away from these rabid fans. Finally, you know, what they did is Joe Weider... I wish they could have. This would have been a great video. Too bad they didn't have the video. Joe Weider and Larry Scott break off in a run down the street with the fans and hotly in pursuit. I mean, it was hilarious to see. Luckily, nobody got hurt. But I'll never forget that, the sight of seeing Joe Weider and Larry Scott running down the street with all the fans running after him. They didn't want to hurt. They just loved Larry Scott.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not that they wanted to hurt him or beat him. No, no,
right,
no.
Right. It was like the Beatles, you know.
I mean, I hate to compare, but Larry Scott was like God to them. These people worshipped him. You know, I mean, you know. And I remember when Joe was holding on to Larry Scott, I remember one of the fans said, hey, Joe, are your magazines true? And Joe says, oh, yeah, absolutely, every word. And the kid says, you're full of shit, Joe. I still remember that. It was hilarious. That was so funny. Those were good times back then, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
What happened was, by the way, in case you're wondering, Joe flagged a cab, and him and Larry jumped in, and they got away from the fans, so nobody was hurt, you know.
Yeah. All right, so that's it. Thank you very much for listening, and glad we got a chance to share all those clips with you. This was part two of our one-year anniversary for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. I had a lot of fun putting these shows together and going back and reminiscing over the last year. I think we did 51 episodes over the last year. So I want to thank all the guests that have joined us over the last year, and I'm really looking forward to another year of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So next week, we will be joined by our interview with Phil Williams. So I'm looking forward to that. And I want to thank our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine, Redcon One, and Old School Labs for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And if you want to contribute to the show, please go to bodybuildinglegendsshow.com and click on the Patreon link on the upper right-hand corner. I appreciate you guys supporting our show. All right. Thanks very much for listening again. We will talk to you guys next week with our interview with Phil Williams. Have a great week, everybody. Take care.